Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. I mean, you can go over to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the podcasts that are going on over there. Maybe you think that you want to explore the New Testament. I mean, Chad doesn't, but you're not all like him. Maybe you are like, well, I think the second part of the Bible is maybe worth at least looking at. Well, that's good, and we have something like that just for you. I'm involved in that. 30 minutes in the New Testament. You can spend 10 less minutes with me and Eric Sorensen going through the New Testament. So that's just one of the things that's over there, among a whole bunch of other things. So if you don't want that, there's something else probably that you want. Go check it out. Chad, the Here We Still Stand conference for 2019. I'm just not even gonna have to bring this up anymore very shortly, because it's gonna be sold out. That's what's gonna happen.
I just registered this morning.
One less ticket. One less for you, listener.
I'm in. Yeah, two less. Me and my wife.
Oh, two less. Yeah,
they better speed it up.
Let's go.
Tickets.
Let's go. Okay. You guys gotta do it. I mean, I don't know where it's at. I haven't looked, but the last time I looked, it was well over 60%. It's probably like 70-75% sold out. I'm just going to bring it up until it sells out, which probably won't be that much longer. So go over to herewestillstand.org. We want you to hang out with us in San Diego. I don't have to tell you how awesome it is. I don't have to tell you what a good time it is. The fact that it sells out so fast tells you all the things you need to know about that. Also, you might be wondering, how is this even a possibility? What's the deal with this conference? Why does it sell out so fast? Well, it sells out so fast because what you get for what you pay for, you know. My ticket was worth a lot more than this. This ticket price did not cover all the things that went on here. You're 100% right if you think that. There's no money being made there. There's no money being made anywhere. Giving away everything that we do, charging insanely low prices for epic conference tickets. It's all made possible. Reaching all those people. Spreading that gospel, all possible by people who are partnering up, doing a little bit. If you would like to partner up with us, if this has been beneficial to you, if you've been served by the stuff that we do, partner up if you're able. And you can go over to 1517 or Christ Will Fast, go to the support page, and you can do that. And thank you so much to those of you who do that, because you do, in fact, make all those things possible. Chad, we're still in that book of Numbers. It's going slower than we ever imagined.
Yeah, we're 14 and a half chapters in, so it's slow but steady progress. Right?
We're getting there. I think we both thought that this is taking about twice as long as we thought it would.
Yeah, I thought we'd be in like Deuteronomy by now.
Yeah. We are not going to be out of Numbers for Christmas. This is the thing.
Yeah. Well, it's just the Spirit's fault. You know, He packed more in here than we anticipated.
He did.
Keep it in first gear. Ease our way through this. We got some more good stuff coming up today. Yeah, we're at verse 20, chapter 14.
All right, let's do it. I think we left them in a little bit of an interesting situation.
Yeah, we certainly did. So the first part of chapter 14 is all about the rebellion of the Israelites. And then beginning around, well, in verse 11 and 12, God speaks. And then beginning with verse 13 all the way through 19, is where we have the prayer of Moses that we spent most of the time talking about last time. This is where he basically argues to God for the reasons that God should not destroy the Israelites, that he should forgive them, and that he shouldn't risk the reputation of his name by destroying the Israelites and thus inviting all sorts of accusations and bad reports from the neighboring peoples, in particular the Egyptians. So that's where we left off last time. That closing verse, which is verse 19 of Numbers 14, says, this is Moses speaking, "Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt even until now." So, of course, that's a great way to leave off his prayer, basically saying, God, keep doing what you've been doing all along. You pardoned the Israelites when they left Egypt. You pardoned them at the crossing of the Red Sea. You pardoned them when they were complaining about the manna and the lack of water. You pardoned them over and over and over. In fact, you even pardoned them when they built the golden calf and committed idolatry right after you gave them the Ten Commandments. So in other words, keep doing what you've been doing. So that's where we left. Now, so how's God going to respond to this? Well, it's a pretty interesting section that we're coming to, because we are going to hear that God pardons. And at the same time, we're also going to hear that there are not just ramifications, but pretty severe ramifications as a result of the people's rebellion. In fact, this particular scenario that's coming up next becomes one of the primary narratives throughout the rest of the scriptures, as well as in the New Testament, of humanity's rebellion against God. In fact, it's kind of interesting. This just came to me now. You know, we talk, as Christians, we talk a lot about the fall of Adam and Eve. I mean, that's like our go-to story, right? If we want to talk about people's rebellion and the fall into sin. And, you know, if we're gonna just pick one story from the Bible that's all about rebellion and sin and its consequences, we almost always jump back to Genesis chapter 3. And what's fascinating, and we do that for good reason, because Paul, for instance, does that more than once in his epistles. But what's interesting to me anyway, is that in the Old Testament, that was not the go-to story at all. I mean, it's there, of course. It's at the very beginning of the Bible. So, of course, it's important and it was known. And you do have some references and some allusions to the fall of Adam and Eve. But over and over, the go-to story for the prophets and the writers of the Psalms is not Genesis 3. It's Numbers 14. So this becomes, in the Old Testament mind, kind of what Genesis 3 is to the New Testament mind. Because if you were to ask a prophet, okay, what's your go-to example for humanity's rebellion against God? They'd say, oh, well, it's when the Israelites rebelled against God at the edge of the promised land. That is the story. I mean, capital T, that is the story of rebellion. You see it featured in many of the Psalms. You see it in the prophets. And it also works its way into the New Testament. Hebrews talks about it. Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians. Jude, that real short one chapter New Testament book, he makes reference to it in verse 5. So it extends from the Old Testament to the New Testament. But I do think it's interesting and perhaps instructive for us who tend to kind of over Genesis 3, the Bible. I mean, that becomes almost, I don't want to say overused, but used to the exclusion of other primary stories. It's instructive for us that maybe this is the story that we should be looking at, because this is the one anyway that many of the writers in the Bible go to when they're looking for an example of unbelief, an example of spurning the gifts of God, an example of saying to God, no, we don't believe your promise. Instead, we believe what our eyes see and what our fearful hearts speak to us instead.
Well, I think the there's a reason for this. If you're talking about how did we get here, that makes sense to go to Genesis 3. That's where that is born. But if you want to know what it looks like, well, you can go to Numbers 14, because one thing that's easy to do is to look at Genesis 3 and you're like, here's one guy and one girl, and look what they did. You're able to sort of roll your eyes a little bit at them, and you're able to say, what the heck, man? I just doubting the promises of God, not listening to him, being disobedient. Look at them. That's just a bad couple right there. What Numbers 14 does is it says, Yeah, here's like a whole mess of people where they're doing the same thing, not believing the promises of God, saying no to him, being rebellious. So, Genesis 3, you have the birth of that, but by Numbers 14, you see like, oh, this really has to spread to everybody.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think we see a whole lot more of ourselves in Numbers 14 than we do in Genesis 3. I mean, Genesis 3 is hard
to relate to.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's kind of hard to put yourself. I mean, nobody can say, you know, I remember when I was sinless, innocent, and perfect in paradise, because it's just not a reality for any of us. But we can certainly put ourselves where the people in Numbers 14 are at, because that is actually where we live. That's like our spiritual address, if you will. That's where we're always at. We're always kind of standing at the brink of the promised land, and we're either going forward or we're rebelling.
Well, one of those two. Well, we can relate to it because we don't really relate to this sort of promise, the sort of promise that, hey, you're in paradise and in perfect fellowship with me. Don't do this thing so you don't get kicked out. Well, that's not the situation we find ourselves in. We're not in that situation, but we can relate to this. Hey, I promise you that I'm going to make everything good and new. I'm gonna give you a promised land. I'm gonna enter you into it. Well, we actually have that promise, and we're still like, nah. Like that. Well, we relate to that, like, because that's exactly the situation we find ourselves in. God has made all kinds of promises about recreating things, about bringing us to the ultimate promised land where we're in right fellowship and have eternal life. Like, we have those promises, and we don't believe them. Those are the things we struggle to believe. So it's much easier to relate to a Numbers 14 kind of thing than this Genesis 3 thing where you're in something that's very good, and the promise of God is, don't do this lest you lose this, as opposed to you're in the fallen world, believe this and you can have all of this. Well, that's the situation we're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is you can kind of think of Numbers 14 as the geography of the sinner saint, right?
Yeah.
This is where you live as a sinner saint. You're at that border, and you're sometimes crossing the border and sometimes going back, or you're standing right on it, and you're pulled this way and that. I mean, that is the civil war, the internal civil war that we all experience. So if you want to think of kind of your spiritual geography, let's read Numbers 14. That's where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, think about this weird situation that Adam and Eve would find themselves in, where they're struggling to believe that death, darkness, decay are a thing. Well, we are not in that situation. None of us are like trying to figure out if death, darkness, decay, destruction are a reality. We know that. What we struggle to believe is the reverse of that. But what do you mean, like a goodness and life and beauty? That's a struggle for us. So, it makes total sense that the Jews would go here because it's much more relatable.
Yeah, and as a we'll take a look in a few minutes at what Hebrews does with this, because this is exactly what the direction that he goes with it as well. So let's see what is said. So Moses ends his prayer, and here's what God says: I have pardoned them according to your word. All right, so far so good. Moses asks, keep forgiving, and God says, all right, that's what you asked for. That's what I will do. And then he goes on, but indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. And surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, they shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it. So this is kind of a both and going on here. God had threatened basically to annihilate all the Israelites and to take Moses and to start over with him. And Moses says, no, that's a bad idea. You're going to ruin your reputation. This is not who you are. In fact, you yourself have described yourself as abundant in loving kindness and slow to anger and forgiving iniquity and all of these divine characteristics of mercy. So you can't do that. You can't be that way. So God says, you're right. And I will. I will pardon them according to your word. And at the same time, he says, those whom I have pardoned, that is to say, whom I will not destroy, I will not give them the ultimate reward for their evil, they nevertheless shall not enter the promised land. And he talks about how they put him to the test these 10 times. I don't know if that's supposed to be literal or if that's just kind of a metaphorical, like they put me to the test and you know, lots of times. I don't know if that's to be taken literally or not, but anyway,
it might be that he's saying, I've always read that, and I don't know that this is true. I've always thought that it's a possibility, because I've thought, why does he say these 10 times? It's a weird thing to say. Yeah. And you go back and you're like, where are they? Like, are they all in here? And it's actually hard to find like what he's talking about. Unless, of course, he's like, I gave you 10 words from Mount Sinai, yeah. and all of them have been just obliterated.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably the best way to take this. Yeah, you've tested me 10 times by breaking repeatedly
all ten of the things.
Yeah. So you've tested me by not listening to me, by rebelling against me. You haven't listened to my voice. And because of that, you're not going to enter into the promised land. He goes on to make a couple of exceptions. He says, my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants will take possession of it. And then a few verses later, he includes Joshua as well. So we talked about that before. These two of the spies, two of the 12 spies, only Joshua and Caleb, are going to enter into the promised land. And of course, Joshua becomes the second Moses. He becomes the successor of Moses, and Caleb figures prominently into the conquest of the Holy Land. So therein, basically, because they believed in the word of God, they didn't spurn him. They didn't reject his promises. If anything, they went the other direction and tried to more or less silence the detractors who were turning the people against God, but unsuccessfully. So then that's kind of the opening speech. And then it goes on, picking up here with verse 26 and following. God starts out with a question. He says, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? Then he says, I've heard their complaints. And then he says, this is interesting. He more or less takes the words that the congregation of Israel spoke against him, and he turns them around on the people. So what they said, see if I can find that back here. Yeah, okay, so earlier in the chapter, verse 3, this is the people speaking, complaining after the spies bring back a bad report. They say, why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. They're going to die. It would have been better for us to return to Egypt. So that's what they said. And so now God kind of turns that around in verse 31, he says, your children, however, whom you said would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. So the people were afraid for their children. At least that's what they said. They were afraid for themselves as well. So God is going to turn this around and say, well, the children that you thought were going to become a prey, well, I'm actually going to give to them the very opposite of what you thought would happen to them. You thought they would die in the promised land. Well, they're going to conquer in the promised land instead. But you, everybody who's 20 years old and upward, everybody who is an adult and is responsible for this rebellion, you are going to turn around and you are going to become prey. You're going to be devoured by the wilderness instead of your children. So that's what's going to happen to them. But there's also consequences for even the children, because it says, verse 33, your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they shall suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness. Like it's going to be 40 years, because there's going to be 1 year in the wilderness for every day that the spies were checking out the land. So verse 34, according to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days for every year, you shall bear your guilt 1 year, 40 years, and you shall know my opposition. So mainly bad news, some good news. The bad news, of course, is that most of the Israelites aren't going in. Everybody 20 years old and upward, except for Joshua and Caleb. I don't remember how old Joshua is at this point. I know Caleb is 40. It kind of gives you a reference point for maybe Joshua is the same age. I didn't check on that. But Caleb is about 40. But everybody else is 20 years old and upward, including Moses and Aaron, as we'll hear a little bit later on, are out. Their corpses will lie in the wilderness. And the sons themselves, they're going to have to wait 40 years until they're able to enter the promised land. It says, the translation I read, it says, they, meaning the children, shall suffer for your unfaithfulness. The Hebrew there is actually your fornications. And this is where we see that very, very common metaphor in the Old Testament for people's unbelief. That is spiritual infidelity or spiritual adultery. Here it's the term is your fornications. That is to say, you were not faithful. You were not believing toward God. Instead, you played the harlot in your heart. And because of that, it's going to take 40 years for all of you to die in the wilderness, and then your children will enter into the promised land. Kind of finish this out, and because there's one more section coming up, very interesting, then we'll talk about a little bit more about some of these details. First of all, 36 through 38, there's an immediate punishment for the spies, the 10 other spies who spoke against God. They are killed by a plague. And then picking up here with 30, 39 and following, this is fascinating. So the people hear all this. They hear about the dire consequences of what's going to befall them and their children because of their evil, unbelieving heart. So what are they going to do? They basically say, we made a mistake. Let us correct it. We are going to redeem ourselves. So they get up the next, Moses says all these words, verse 39, the people mourn greatly, they're upset, they're grieving because of what God has said is going to happen to them. So what do? Well, they get up early the next morning, and they go up to the ridge of the hill country, and here's what they say. Here we are. We have indeed sinned. So, I mean, they admit that. We messed up royally. We indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised. And Moses says, why are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord when it won't succeed? Don't go up, because if you do, you're going to get struck down by your enemies because the Lord is not among you. He says the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there, and they're going to unsheathe their swords, and they're going to hack you down because you have turned back from following the Lord, and the Lord will not be with you. But the people, they don't listen, verse 44. So it says they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country, and the Ark of the Covenant wasn't with them, and Moses didn't go with them. And the result was that the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in the hill country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah. Now, the reason I was thinking over and over about this this particular section here, trying to just get a good grip on what the primary message of this is, and I think I've got it. I think this is an instance of people basically trying to, they've screwed up, they've sinned, and they're trying to redeem themselves. You know, we messed up, we should have listened to God, and now God has threatened all this, and we realize that we failed, and we don't want to bear the consequences of our failure. So what we're going to do is we're going to take matters into our own hands, and we're going to impress God by our willingness now, and we're going to make it up to him. We're going to show him that we can do this. We're going to show him how faithful we are. We're going to end up redeeming ourselves. But the result is that they just added sin to sin.
Yeah.
As a result of this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of this can be a little bit perplexing because you're like, wait, I mean, so like, did he like not really pardon them? Did he not really forgive them? And I think that you have to look at this in terms of what God was wanting to do, which he said was just wipe everyone out, which he doesn't do. I think you have to, when you hear pardon also, you have to think about this not just in the, you know, in the immediate, but in the spiritual sense of God is not going to hold this against them. They might die in the wilderness, but this does not mean that they will be forever cut off from God. So you might end up dying in the wilderness, but you will die in the wilderness and then go be with the Lord. But you will not enter the promised land there. I mean, and of course, I mean, that's what ultimate forgiveness is about. It's about the next life coming. So I think the pardon is real. The forgiveness is real. But the consequences are real too. And what they're trying to do here is say, yeah, but what if we do something incredible to make up for it? And then you'll realize, like, you know what? What you're trying to do is you're trying to obtain what God has promised you in your own strength, which is a bad idea. You're going when he hasn't said to go. In fact, he's said the opposite.
Yeah, they've rebelled in a couple of different ways. You know, first, you think of it this way. So first God says, yes, go into the promised land. And they say no. And then God turns around and says, no, you're not going to the promised land. And they say, yes. So, I mean, it's the same sin, just in two different scenarios. In both cases, they're taking what God explicitly said and they're turning their backs on it. So it's really a case of they're trying to earn God's forgiveness by self-appointed acts of redemption or something like that. They're trying to get back on his good side and obtain his promises, but in a way that he himself has not given to them. I mean, it'd be kind of like, suppose a person commits a robbery. They get caught and they get sentenced to a prison term. And instead of, enduring their sentence, their justly deserved sentence, they break out of jail and go somewhere and try and live an honest, upright life in order to prove that they're a good person. And in so doing, they add sin to sin. Not only did they commit robbery, but that now they've broken out of prison. So it's kind of like this with the Israelites. You know, they said no to God, we're not going in. And rather than being willing to endure the discipline that God imposes upon them, they say, no, we're going to prove to God just how good we can be. But when they do that, they're basically trying to live by a righteousness that is their own. They're proceeding, in other words, according to their own word rather than according to the word that God has given to them. How's this chapter used in the New Testament? What I was referring to earlier. I think probably the most well-known usage is in 1 Corinthians. And it's fascinating to me the way that Paul, you can kind of picture Paul preaching about this. So he knows this story very well. And he's of course addressing a congregation that has a ton of problems. Corinth was not a congregation that was peaceful and without a lot of struggles. They had everything on there, from internal schisms between the people, to jealousies and envy, to sexual immorality, to problems at the Lord's Supper, to you name it. It's kind of like if you take every congregation that you know that has problems and bring them all together into one church, that's Corinth. That's Corinth for you. So in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul uses not just this story, but kind of the whole wilderness narrative to apply it to the Israelites. And the way he starts out is he uses language that kind of it's language that Christians are more familiar with, and he sort of retells this story of the Israelites in more Christian language. So he starts out the chapter saying that that our brethren, the Israelites, they were all under the cloud. They passed the sea, and they were baptized into Moses. So we have this baptism language. He says, well, they ate the same spiritual food. They drank the same spiritual drink. They drank from the rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. So he's Christianizing this Old Testament narrative. But then he switches. He says, okay, they had all this. They had this spiritual kind of sacramental food and drink, and they were baptized into Moses just like we're baptized into Christ. But he says, with most of them, God wasn't well pleased because they were laid low in the wilderness. So, well, that's the exact language we just heard in Numbers. It says this happened as an example for us. And then he goes on to list how this is exemplary for us. He says, don't be idolaters as some of them were, and don't act immorally as some of them did, and don't test the Lord as some of them did, and don't grumble as some of them did. And then he says in verse 11, now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written down for our instructions, upon whom the end of the ages have come. Therefore, this is a verse that we know well. I don't think we always understand the context, though. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So Paul is pointing us back to Numbers 14 as an example, as I mentioned earlier, of the rebellion. And as Jude will say, of an evil, unbelieving heart, as Hebrews will say, an evil, unbelieving heart is what leads to this. So this becomes an example, yes, of God's grace in that he didn't destroy the Israelites, but also of what happens when instead of believing God's word and trusting that he is faithful to his promise, we instead believe, we follow our own hearts and we believe our own fears and test the Lord in that way and end up not being able to fully receive the gifts that he wills to give to us.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that Paul makes pretty clear is that one of the things that you need to be careful of is thinking that this is somehow not you. That's his argument, right? He goes through all these things like, hey, there's an example here. Stay away from this. Stay away from that. Stay away from the other thing. And stay away from thinking that this isn't you. Mm-hmm. Or else, most surely, it is you.
Yeah, it's kind of the same trick that he pulls in the first part of Romans, where he talks all about sin and rebellion and all this stuff. And you can kind of see the believers in Rome shaking their heads like, that's exactly right. And then he turns the tables on them, right, and says, therefore, you are without excuse.
Right.
Because this, as you said, this is you. These aren't just ancient peoples who had rebellious, unbelieving hearts. These people are, in fact, this is your story. It isn't just their story. This is your story as well. So as Hebrews will use this particular story, he says, no, this is the rest is still there. The promise is still there. So take heed lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart which spurns the promises of God. So this is where we live. This is our daily struggle. And Numbers 14 is basically the biography, the spiritual biography of our life every day. This is kind of where we're at.
Yeah, that's it. Well, we got just a few minutes left.
Well, that's kind of good, because this next section won't take us very long, because it's almost as if Moses took a whole bunch of stuff from Leviticus and put it here into Numbers. It's kind of a strange transition. I honestly can't really completely grasp why this is here. So what we switch to, and keep in mind, there's as we have talked before, you got to kind of ignore your chapter divisions here and your verse divisions. So just imagine reading along in the original, and you read, and he beat them down as far as Hormah. And then the next words you hear are, now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you're entering the land, here are the sacrifices that I want you to offer. So it's sort of it's an odd transition. And maybe it's there almost as a transition, if you know what I mean, rather than going right until the next narrative, which in chapter 16 is going to be one more rebellion. Maybe it's put here as sort of a literary break, if you will. So it needed to go somewhere, and so the author ended up putting it here. Basically, what we have in the first 21 verses of Numbers 15 is a description of the various sacrifices and the accompanying items that are supposed to go with them that we have covered extensively when we went through Leviticus. So he's saying, look, you're gonna spend a lot of time in the wilderness, 40 years, but your children are going to enter into the promised land. And when they do, here's what I want them to offer by way of burnt offerings and thanksgiving offerings and sin offerings. You're going to offer your sacrifice, but you're also going to offer flour with it and oil with it and wine with it. That is to say, the fruits of the earth, the fruits of the vineyard are going to be offered along with this as a way of giving back to God what he's given to you. And this particular section also makes a point that it doesn't matter if you're an Israelite by blood, or if you're a stranger or a sojourner, an alien who's living in the midst of the Israelites, the same applies to you as well. So, I mean, that's something I don't think we always realize, that it wasn't just the Israelites, but it was even believing non-Israelites who were dwelling in the land who could offer these sacrifices as a way of giving thanks to God for his gifts to us. So that's the way that the transition that's worked in. That's the first half of chapter 15. So you kind of have here it's almost a breath of fresh air in some ways after what we've just read in Numbers 14, because it's God's implicit way of confirming his promise to the Israelites. So this all just went down. It's bad news for the adult Israelites. They're going to not enter the promised land. In fact, they're going to all die in the wilderness. Their children, however, will. God is going to bring them in. He's going to see them through. And when they enter into the promised land, they are not only just enter, but they're also going to settle there, raise crops and vineyards there to such an extent that they will have the means whereby to offer these sacrifices as a thanksgiving to God for his gifts toward them. So this is sort of a not so direct way of God confirming what he's already promised to the children in Numbers chapter 14.
Yeah, this is sort of him saying, not only am I going to be faithful and get you into the promised land, I actually have explicit instructions for you when you get there. Which is sort of just a confirming action by God's on God's part, saying you will get there, and when you get there, have all these things happen, and a lot of this stuff will have to be passed down because a lot of these people won't make it.
Right.
Yeah, and that's it, man. That is 40 minutes. That's it. All right, well, guys, we will continue on. We're not done with rebellions yet. You would think that would be enough. You'd think that was it. Not the case. Not the case, Chad. These people are slow learners.
Yeah. Too bad they can't be like us.
Yeah, they can't be. They just can't get it. They can't get it together the way that we have. All right, guys, we will see you next week.